And again, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's TechNet webcast. Microsoft.com Operations introduces real-world debugging, debugging CLR internals. Before we get started, I'm going to turn the floor over to our MC, Chris Adams.
All right, thank you, Tracy, and I appreciate it. And welcome, everybody, to the continuation of this awesome series that we've got going on this week in the IaaS webcast series. My name is Chris Adams. I'm the IaaS Program Manager, and as many of you know, I do a lot of the webcasts in the IaaS webcast series. But in this case, we need the experts to come on site and do the Microsoft.com operation, introduce this real-world debugging. We want to thank them for participating this week because it's giving us a lot of great information for you as to not how it should work, but exactly how it does work. And so with that said, I'm going to go ahead and remind you that this week, Monday through Friday, we are hosting these guys to talk to us about this debugging situation that we have at Microsoft.com. We want to make sure that you are aware of how you can get access to the information. You can certainly visit www.iswebcastseries.com to see what are the events that are coming up on the remaining days of this week. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and turn over the floor to Jeff Stuckey. Jeff is a systems engineer manager. That is the guru for all of the gurus that are presenting this week, for those of you that want to know. And he is going to talk to us today about debugging the CLR internals. Jeff, take it away.
Thanks, Chris. Welcome, everybody. We'll go ahead and cover some prerequisites that would be really good to have for this particular webcast. It'd be good if you had familiarity with the native Windows debuggers. They are downloadable through the Download Center. Just search for debugging tools. Also, great if you could be familiar with .NET Managed Code and the .NET Garbage Collection or Garbage Collected Heap. So real quick on the agenda, I'll go over the particular goals of this webcast. And then we'll dig into the CLR exceptions, runtime exceptions in ASP.NET, and also the garbage collector. So the goals for this webcast, basically they're just to provide some insight into the functioning of the CLR's exception handling and garbage collection mechanisms, just to give you better idea of how they operate and how they could affect the performance of your web servers. Also to demonstrate what tools that we use for investigating issues with exceptions and GC. And also to give you some recommendations on best practices that we use for exceptions and GC activity to at least hopefully improve performance, but at least avoid performance bottlenecks and hits that way. So let's go ahead and dig into CLR exceptions in ASP.NET. So what are exceptions? A lot of people have different definitions for exceptions. I tend to think of them as just a mechanism for reporting errors in applications and also protecting managed applications from potentially fatal errors. They're a tool that you can use to either catch an error and correct it before your application terminates, or at least report the error so that you can troubleshoot it later. Different exception types, you have some non-fatal exception types and also some fatal exception types. Typically in a web server environment, the non-fatal exception types that you run into are null reference exceptions, argument null exceptions, file not bounds, thread aborts. Most of these exceptions are logged by ASP.NET into the event logs, with the exception of thread abort, unless it is a page timeout, in which case a thread abort will get logged. For fatal type exceptions, those are typically configuration and compilation type exceptions. So if you have bad syntax on your pages, or if you have made an error in one of your config files, or can't either read the config file or just as a value that doesn't make any sense, you'll get those thrown. Also, exceptions that occur on asynchronous I/O threads, or if you're doing any async I/O and you happen to throw an exception on one of those threads, it probably will be terminal for your application unless you handle it properly. But generally, those are not caught, and so they go unhandled and cause the application or the worker process to terminate. Why should you care about these exceptions? What we've seen in our experience over the last few years dealing with ASP.NET is exceptions can create a performance drag on your system. If you just have one application that's throwing just a few exceptions and that's all you got going on your system, then you probably really won't notice it that much. But in our environment, where you have potentially hundreds of applications and each of them could be throwing a ton of exceptions, it really adds up to a performance drag. Another obvious result of throwing these exceptions is it can limit your overall throughput of your application, especially if you're just throwing a ton of exceptions per second. It's just not great for the throughput of your application. Improperly handled exceptions can destabilize your system or your application, typically your application, but if you have a situation where you catch an exception but you're not doing something proper with the exception, if you're just swallowing an exception, if it's some kind of critical exception that should really be thrown back up and you're not doing that, you could end up destabilizing your application. And if that causes your application to start consuming memory or do something else, that could potentially destabilize your system and just make it non-responsive. High volume of exceptions per request really do indicate a poorly written application. I mean, if an application is throwing a bunch of exceptions, those really should be handled in a different manner. Exceptions should be for exceptional situations only. They should be checking for null references and file not found and whatever else before you actually get to the point where an exception is thrown. It also increases the difficulty for troubleshooting higher priority failures. So if you're looking at an application in a debugger and you have in your worker process, you have a bunch of other applications that are throwing exceptions, it is very distracting. It's almost impossible to troubleshoot that particular application because there's so much else going on. In that event, we typically, in our environment, we'll typically isolate an application into its own worker process just to make that debugging a lot easier. But it's nice when you don't have to do that. So where can you view exceptions? The easiest place, obviously, is perfmon. There's perf count of .NET CLR exceptions, number of exceptions thrown per second. Covers all of the exceptions thrown on the machine. You can select an instance, a worker process instance, or a global instance. Another location is the application event log. For ASP.NET specifically, for version 2.0, they started logging all unhandled exceptions to the application event log. If you just do a filter on web events, that'll show you all of those. I believe Jeff Johnson did a great webcast yesterday on using log parser to extract those events from the application log. Also, if you have a user mode debugger CDB or WinDBG attached to your process, you can set an exception breakpoint on CLR type exceptions, and that will allow you to dig into what exactly the exception needs and what's causing it. And we'll go into that a little bit later in the webcast. So we'll go right into a couple demos on exceptions. I'll be covering ThreadWare exceptions, and then we'll look at some other type exceptions and debugging those. log in here real quick. Okay. My window's a little messed up. So our first sample here is just really a simple page that is just doing the redirect and response.redirect. Not a lot of people know that the default behavior for a response redirect is to throw a thread abort exception, which is actually very distracting in a debugger. And it has a little bit of overhead to it, which I'll show you real quick. So this particular code, okay, I take the query string parameter of abort to decide whether or not to do a thread abort. As you can see, I have thread abort true, thread abort false. They're both give you the same end result, but what happens under the covers is a little bit different. So let me... So what we'll do here first is I have a little utility that basically kicks off a TinyGet, which is a utility just to do an HTTP request from command line. And I'm going to loop. What I'm doing is I'm looping 5,000 requests to this particular thread abort or this response at redirect page, first passing false parameter, so there's no actual thread abort happening. And then we'll do with the thread abort. As you can see, our average time taken for this loop. Now, this is really an exaggerated example. I mean, this, you know, I'm looping through, you know, 5,000 response redirect requests. But it's just, it's an example of what kind of overhead you could potentially see if you do a lot of this redirecting. So you can see our average time taken without the thread abort, 5.76 seconds versus almost 7 seconds for doing the thread abort. So we'll go ahead and we'll go ahead and attach a debugger and look at this real quick. Okay, so I have my debugger attached. We'll go ahead and hit the page. You can see, I feel our exception was just logged in the debugger. I can keep hitting this, and every time I hit this page, it's just a simple redirect, a thread abort gets thrown. So we're going to go real quick and take a look at that. So the debugger extension that we use is called SOS, Son of Strike, which is included in the framework. I'm actually going to set, I'm going to set my extension enabled for CLR. I'll go ahead and resume, hit the page one more time. Okay, now the debugger is broken into this thread that just threw the thread abort exception. I can do a native K, which is using the Windows native call stack. And it actually understands managed code. Not quite as pretty as the Son of Strike, but it actually gives you all of the native code above that. So we can see we have our page load, which is where I'm executing all the code. A response that redirect ends up calling into response, HTTP response.end, which makes the thread abort call, ends up going up into kernel 32 raise exception. For this raise exception, what happens is the exception handler in kernel 32 will actually walk the stack and he'll look for a handler to handle this exception. in this case, I believe ASP.NET actually handles this particular exception. They actually register a global exception handler, so they will catch pretty much any exception that happens on a regular thread, and worst case, they'll terminate the request. The page won't be served, and they'll log an exception to that log. So using SLS, we can just real quick look at CLR stack, which gives you the managed, just the managed portion of the stack. And it has some nice features. We can do a bang you for unassembly on that return address. I don't know how many people are familiar with the regular disassembler for the debugger. This is a little bit different in that it shows you, it unassembles the whole function call, and it gives you these little arrows that tell you exactly where you are in the function. In this case, we just called system.learning.threadboard. All right. Let's go ahead and move to the next demonstration here. So with a debugger attached, things get a little bit more interesting. I'm going to disable my CLR exception handling. And I'm going to kick off the little timer again. Okay, so what we got going on here now is I'm looping in a much larger loop against that page. And you can see in perfmon, there's no exceptions being thrown. Everything's fine. I mean, the system's running pretty good. Actually, let me change this just a little bit. We'll just do I'm gonna do a sample here. So we'll do one loop, 5,000. So I'm gonna loop just one quick loop of 5,000 requests, and we'll look at the time. No exceptions being thrown. 6.3 seconds. Great. We'll change our parameter to true. Start doing a threadabort. Now you can see, obviously, we got ton of exceptions being thrown per second. The interesting behavior is that when you're running a debugger against a process and it's doing a lot of exceptions, it really slows down. I was actually quite shocked when I first saw this. Doing this, just setting up this demo, I mean, it takes forever. I mean, it's, I don't know, 20 seconds. We won't even wait for that thing to finish here. All right, so the next thing that we're going to do, I'm going to go ahead and detach this debugger. So with any user mode debugger, I guess from XP through Server 2003, they enabled a detach feature. So you can detach from a process without killing it, which is quite nice. So I went ahead and detached.
Hey, Jeff, quick question.
You bet.
I was just wondering what you were... Sorry, we're getting an echo here. So I was just wanting to jump in about that. So you're saying, obviously, that Threadboard is an expensive task. What is... Jeff touched on it briefly yesterday, but what is your recommendation to our customers for doing this in the least expensive way if they have to do these redirects?
So our recommendation, and this, I'll cover this in a later slide, is basically just to pass the false parameter to avoid having the threadboard exceptions. You may need to change some of your code. So what happens when the threadboard is not thrown is that your code runs through. So if you have a function and you have a redirect in the middle, your code's going to complete through past that redirect. So typically all that's required is actually issuing a return after you issued a response redirect with the false parameter, and then your function will exit there.
Do you at Microsoft.com have a limit to the amount of times or something that you guys find, you know, per app? Is there a certain cap that you say that we just shouldn't do it more than these amount of redirects, or are you not worried about that? You're only worried about the false parameter.
We term it in terms of exceptions. Our guidelines for people that are putting code out to our website is zero exceptions per second.
Okay, so you're not worried about the number total of redirects. No. You're only worried about them doing it correctly.
We're only worried about these exceptions. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, for sure.
Thanks.
So real quick, I'll show you guys a, I think. I apologize, a little delay here. I kind of threw these together last minute. So what we're going to do here is, Rick, so I'm going to show you kern rate, which is a profiling tool for basically profiling CPU utilization on a box. If you have a machine that is CPU strapped and you want to determine exactly where the CPU time is being spent, kern rate is a great tool for finding that out. So what I've done here is I've launched the little loop tool to hit that page continuously with TinyGet, and then I'm using KernRate to profile that activity. And this is with the false parameter, so I'm not doing thread aborts. I'll go ahead and control C out of here, and we'll just really quickly look at the output. Not to dig into this too much, but you can see it shows you your four processors, what their utilization was, gives you interrupt rates, etc. Gives you some more information about just general memory utilization on the server. The really interesting stuff is actually here down there at the bottom. It breaks out your kernel time, where your CPU time is being spent in kernel, and then below that, I am profiling specifically the worker process that was 3WP, and it shows us the modules that our CPU time is being spent in as well. And we can zoom in on these modules to further investigate what function calls are being exercised inside those modules. So here, you know, it's kind of normal operation. This is what we would expect to see in terms of, you know, what we're doing. I'm going to go ahead and change this. We're going to launch. So we'll launch the same one. Except this time, we'll be doing it against the thread abort. And we can see, you know, 700 odd exceptions on per second. We'll let kern rate run here for just a couple seconds to get make sure we have a really good data point here. And we'll go ahead and break in. Alright, so the behavior's changed a little bit. We noticed that now MS Core Works is at the top of the list, and third, which is pretty interesting, is mtdll, which is typically system type functions, system and thread type functions. So we're you know, we say, okay, this is interesting. I want to see more about what this is. We're going to kick off the same thing. But this time, my batch file is going to include the Z switch for zooming in on mtdll and MS4Works. Again, we'll let it run for just a couple seconds. This tool is pretty lightweight. It's, like I said, it's a profiling tool and based off of sampling. So it's sampling the CPU utilization instead of tracking every clock cycle, but it does a very good job at determining where your CPU time is being spent. So we'll control C in here. You can see we have a lot more output here. I gotta scroll up quite a bit to get to where our zoom is. Come on, underscore works here. Huge. Okay. So same, you know, general list here. Underscore works, MPP allow. We look at the top function in underscore works. And sure enough, it's stack walk frames EX, which is basically a function to walk the call stack, looking for exception handlers. And if you scroll down to MPDLL, scrolling, we see top function for MPDLL is RTL lookup function entry, and followed closely by RTL virtual unwind. So MPDLL is spending a lot of time unwinding stacks and analyzing function names just to find the exception handler that will handle the exception for this thread abort exception. So that is thread abort. We'll go right into a try-catch exception example. So what I have here is another very contrived example to show a few different types of exceptions and kind of best practice for how to handle this. This thing basically is a page that takes a parameter of fname, and it gets the timestamp, the last modified timestamp, and it also outputs the contents of the file to the browser. So this is an example. I ran it against itself. I was working on this thing at 9 this morning, something like the last minute, and output the contents of the file. Not too terribly exciting. We'll go ahead and kind of just mess with it and see the different ways that it will blow up, because it's already written because I wrote it. And this is the cache result. So I don't pass in a parameter. It says, yeah, you know what? I can't find what you were supposed to pass me. It looks like now this call stack here that I'm showing you is basically being displayed because I'm local to the box. And I can see in process we're calling get last write time. Get last write time is throwing an argument null exception. So I guess my path is null. Yeah, that's probably what I'd expect because I'm not doing any checking for my first string parameter. Bad knee. So I'll see what else I can do to add file that text, which doesn't exist. That's another catch result. Alright, so here's a system file not found exception. Yeah, sure enough, in this particular case is actually pretty interesting because if you look at the error, I'm in output file, which means I already got past the get timestamp, even though the file didn't exist. Kind of a strange oddity that I noticed doing this demo. So if we actually pull up Event Viewer, go into the application log, here's something at 9:59, unhandled exception. Yeah, sure enough. Argument null exception value cannot be found. So this was one of the exceptions that was thrown for the get last write time. So what do we do? This is all kinds of options here. We'll go ahead and I'm being told to maximize my current window. And let's see if we can can do that. I'm not quite sure how to do that. Sorry about that, folks. Different people are having some problems seeing this whole thing. Anyway, we'll go ahead.
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. I'm just going to let you know, the visual studio is fine.
Yeah.
The command prompt is where we were getting some feedback. It was a smaller window. Ooh. When it's scrolling and you're moving through, it's just kind of bars.
Sure.
So when you're working in the command prompt, could you maximize that if you don't mind?
You bet.
That's the only one you needed to maximize. Perfect. Okay. That just scrolls the scrolling down in the video.
Just to let folks know, also, the commands that I'm doing in the debugger and this other output, we'll go ahead and capture that and post it to our blog site, the MSCOM blog site, just so you have that for reference. So what I'll do real quick here is I'm going to comment out this. We'll go ahead and uncomment. So here, now we are checking for at least a null file, and we'll see what happens in our example. Alright, so at least now I'm catching it. Okay. I have to pass the file name parameter. Whoa. Uh-oh. Okay. I'm having a little slight difficulty here with my system. Whoa. Okay. Brutal. Alright, so I got the little problems going on with my brand new system. It's gonna take me a second here. Please bear with me, folks, as I get the thing going again. Well, while that system's rebooting and that demo is still hanging out, I'll go ahead and talk about our recommendations for exception handling. Chris, if you wouldn't mind just moving the slide ahead.
Yes. Okay, give me just a second here. I'm trying to wake this bad boy up as well. So your actual machine cracked?
My actual machine, yeah.
That's a serious thread abort you did going on there. So whatever that demo is, it really worked. So were you on the tri-cache or the thread abort? I'm assuming you want to go to the exception recommendation?
Yeah, let's just go to
that. Does that look good?
Yeah.
All right, run with it from there.
Well, I think it looks good because I actually can't
see anything. So you lost everything.
Yeah. So, exception recommendations. Like Chris and I discussed earlier, we really try to prevent exceptions from happening. They are truly for exceptional situations. You may hear some arguments from people like Richter about, you know, how exceptions are great, and it's worth the performance hit. And I think that does apply for WinForm applications or console applications, what have you. But I think in a web server environment, where you're really trying to get as much throughput as you can out of your web servers, it's best to try and find errors before they happen instead of using exception handling to protect yourself. And not to say that you don't want to protect yourself, because ultimately you don't want your applications crashing. But for normal operation, for you know your application is going to run through these particular code paths, you need to at least do your parameter checking and all that stuff for the normal code path, and then use exception handling for those potential exceptional errors. Don't eat exceptions is another recommendation we have. An example of that is you do a try catch around some code, and in your catch block you don't have anything. You just don't take any corrective action. You don't refer the exception. It's basically just hiding an error, concealing an error that probably should be dealt with. Because you have no idea how your application is going to behave after that, after the exception was thrown. Another recommendation, avoid the response.redirect thread abort exception. Just a good best practice. I'm logging into my machine here, see if I can get back on.
So the next topic that you were rolling to was about TLR garbage collection. So just thinking that we could transition into that while your machine's booting up there.
Sure. Actually, I forgot to mention this last recommendation. It's a little bit cryptic. For ASP.NET 2.0, they made a change in the exception handler such that when unhandled exceptions get thrown, they actually tear down the worker process. They terminate the worker process, which we found was a bad thing because we have some code out there that, and this is more related to unhandled exceptions on the async IO threads. But anyway, we ended up with worker processes just disappearing. Nothing was logged. They just went away, and it was starting to create some problems once we actually noticed it, because there was not a lot of indication other than an occasional availability hit in our monitoring tools. So there's a link that I have here that talks about going back to the legacy exception handling behavior from Everett.
So quick, just want to clarify what you just said. You're saying that in 2.0, the exception handling, if it bubbles all the way up to the app, it will terminate the IIS worker process or the app domain?
It will terminate the IIS worker process. Terminate process, baby.
Okay, so it kills our process. It's good to know. So what did you do to work around that? Use the legacy mechanism?
We flipped the switch so that it does no longer kills the application, and there's some debate as far as, is that the best thing to do? Because, you've just now swallowed an unhandled exception, which I've been telling you not to do, but for us, it was better than losing the worker process that housed, several other, or potentially 100 other applications, and we're just having to be more proactive in debugging to try and track these down. So we'll operate a worker process under the debugger to try and catch these. And we've had some success at actually tracking down the culprits and taking care of those. We may end up going back to that behavior. It's kind of a little bit too early to tell at this point. All right. I did kind of want to show you the other demo, but we'll go ahead and start getting into GC. All right, so garbage collector. Basically, the GC managed GC motto is allocate fast, pay later. They've architected in such a way that any allocations you do for local variables or strings or anything is allocated extremely quickly. But eventually, when you start running the machine into memory pressure, either through memory leaks or just excessive use of ASP.NET cache or other caches, when the GC occurs, the garbage collection occurs, and the free objects are deleted. Actually, they're not really deleted. They're just kind of ignored. But when the compaction occurs, you have a lot of CPU overhead in doing that, which they do try to minimize. On multiprocessor machines, which probably describes most web servers, the default behavior for the TLR is to use what they call the server GC. So each processor, four dedicated GCs. So that was a four processor example. Each processor in a multiprocessor machine has a dedicated GC thread, each with their own segment. They do this kind of to improve performance and localize memory access per processor, and also to not block allocations. Segments are pre-allocated on startup, and the size is depending on architecture. So for 32-bit, I think I have some notes here. 32-bit, I think the size is 64 meg segments with 32 meg large object key on x64 bit. The segments are 1 gig. That's right, 1 gig, and large objects being a quarter of that, so 256 meg. The GC threads run at an elevated priority, which is very interesting. They do this so that the GC can complete it as quickly as possible and not be blocked by other like priority threads. It can create some interesting behavior on a machine. So the GC activity, they suspend all managed threads in the worker process, or in the in the worker process, do their GC, and then they free up the threads to continue doing their work. So if you have a situation where the GC is taking a long time to run, you effectively are not serving any requests during that GC time. So they run at high priority to get that work done as quickly as possible, so you block less. The GC is separated into generations. You have Gen 0, 1, and 2. This is also an optimization so that short-lived objects, which are allocated on Gen 0, are cleaned up much quicker. And the longer-lived objects, which eventually get promoted through 1 up to Generation 2, are collected less frequently, so you have less of an overhead for your long-lived objects. Collections occur when there's not a free space for an allocation, also when the CLR detects that there's memory pressure on the machine, which is they issue an API call to detect from the system what the current memory load is on the system, and then they determine whether they need to issue a collection to free up space. GC activity is monitored mainly through the perf counters, through the .NET CLR memory perf counter. And as far as the collection, rate of collections, your optimal ratio is 10 to 1 from the Gen 0 collections, number of Gen 0 collections to number of Gen 1 collections, and then the same for Gen 1 to Gen 2, 10 to 1 is the recommended guideline. So we will do another demo here of the GC initialization, assuming I can get my TS box going again. Okay, does everybody see that? Anyone see that? Okay. So what I'm going to demonstrate here real quick is just the GC initializing. Oh, I have a debugger window here that's going to go ahead and just issue a ASIP request. Actually, first what I'll do is go ahead and reset lab focus. GC is already initialized. Use a did not recycle. Okay. I'm having a little problem getting to my computer management here. Here we go. Go ahead and recycle it that pool. All right. Go ahead and attach the debugger to the worker process. We'll issue a quick request just to make sure he's initialized, and then we'll go ahead and what I'll do here is I'm going to set a couple breakpoints that I just tooling around that I was looking at GC initialization and kind of figured out where it was occurring. So I set a breakpoint on this MS4Works GC heap initialize function. And then we'll go ahead and just issue a request to one of our managed applications. And it's really an application. So we hit this breakpoint. I can do a KV. Ooh, I'll just do a K. And you'll see P startup is the execution engine startup. This is kind of the main thread for starting up the CLR. And I'll set another breakpoint on the call to kernel 32 virtual alloc. Virtual alloc is the main function for all memory allocations being done, and here we can see, sure enough, we're in GC heap initialize. This particular request or call stack is not really the one that we're interested in. We're going to go one more time. So here we're doing the reserve initial memory request. And if I look at, I do an unassemble before on this return address to virtual alloc, we can see how the virtual alloc is pushing arguments onto the stack to pass to kernel 32 virtual alloc. If we show our registers, the one that's really interesting here is our RDX register. So if I just do a print at RDX, we can see, sure enough, wow, that's a big number. So 5 gigs. This is the memory that the CLR is reserving as it starts up. Believe it or not, on an X64 system, they reserve 5 gigs of memory for each worker process that you have. So you say to yourself, well, that's huge, and it is. But they do really well as far as not collecting on that. They reserve it, but they don't commit as much memory.
But that's native 64, right, Jeff?
This is, in fact, native 64, yeah.
Okay, so WoW 64, what do they alloc by default?
WoW 64 is, so that's city code that's setting the 32-bit framework.
Right.
So they allocate, I think I wrote it down, so I wouldn't have to remember. So here we are. 32-bit server GC, they allocate 64 meg segment sizes, so 64 meg per processor, and then 32 meg large object key. Now, so this is the server GC. So we've been working with the CLR team because we've run into an issue now where we're running 11 worth of processes. Each of them have the server GC running. Each of them have four high priority threads trying to do GC work. This is potentially dangerous because depending on timing of when collections happen, you could really drag out the collections for one particular worker process if it gets interrupted in any way by any of the other high-pri GC threads for any of the worker processes. So the guidance that we've been given is to go with what they call the workstation GC. And you can see, hopefully you can see on my notepad here, setting is in ASP.NET config. And the setting is GC server enabled equals false. Now what this does is it converts the behavior. Instead of having four dedicated GC threads running at high pri with their own segments, you have one GC thread, and the allocation that it does for 64 meg native 64-bit machine is 256 meg with a 128 meg large object key. So if you have a lot of worker processes, 64-bit or 32-bit, it doesn't matter. Just if you have a lot of worker processes on a multiprocessor machine, the guidance is to run this workstation GC. It reduces the overall footprint, the initial footprint of the CLR. I believe it kind of starts out faster. I haven't really measured the startup time yet, but it's definitely something that we need to do. On 32-bit systems, your allocations are even smaller, 16 meg initial segment and 16 meg large object key. Another option is something that we've played around with, a little bit undocumented, is the GC segment size registry key, which you can hopefully see here. Under HC Local Machine Software Microsoft.NET Framework. This basically adjusts the, configures the segment sizes for server or workstation, I believe, but we have been using it mainly for server GC to configure our 64-bit machine down to the segment sizes that the 32-bit machines we're using, just to see how it impacts performance. We've had pretty positive results. So anyway, that's just kind of for your information. Alright, that's probably all. Well, anyway, real quick, I'll just show you. You have to confirm. We have virtual bytes for W3WP. Right now we're at 99 meg. And if I just let this one allocation go through, I hit G, peek over here, yeah, sure enough, we're at 5 gig of reserve space. Again, this is reserve space, pretty fast to allocate. I mean, extremely fast. Committing is really where you hit a penalty, but just to demonstrate what kind of overall footprint the CLR can have. So we'll go back to... we're having a long period of silence for it. Go back to our slides. So GC behavior in production. This is what we see in our systems in production. The ASP.NET caching generally drives your managed heat fills. I don't know, 90% of our applications, when we look at GC activity, and we look at overactivity, high CPU utilization because of GC, ASP.NET caching is generally the culprit. People either are cashing items with no expiration policy, or they're just cashing as much as they can. that's our experience. Gen 1 size is typically very small compared to the Gen 0 and Gen 2 sizes. The collection ratios really do vary depending on the application. Some of our less memory-intensive applications do hit the 10-to-1 recommended ratio or better, and some of the others do not. Cost of GC is driven by the number of objects that survive, not the total number of objects, which is kind of what our perception was when we started digging into the performance of GC. We talked it over with one of the architects for the GC, and he explained that it's the number of objects that survive that really impact the performance of the GC. On X64, with many application tools, the system can experience memory pressure, which can be catastrophic in terms of GC activity. So basically what happens is you have a lot of applications, they are all caching, and they're driving the system down to the point where GC says, ask the system, what's the memory load? And it says, I'm this full. And the GC says, this is memory pressure, I better start collection. Well, all 11 app pools see this at the same time, and they all start collecting. And when this happens, the second bullet can happen, which is pretty cool. Since the GC threads are running at high priority, they can block even HTTP.sys from taking connections. So that the behavior that we saw was, our availability tests, we were failing on some request to static GIF file, which is just bizarre. You wouldn't expect a static GIF to have a connection failure, or any kind of failure for that matter. And it turned out that it was GC activity that was killing us. We'll just go ahead and skip the demo on the GC operation. Basically, what I was going to show you was on our live system for Perfmon over our 11 app pools. Really, the GC behavior is different between all the different app pools. Some of the app pools have very good ratios of collection, and others do not. The one thing you want to look out for is the number of induced GCs. So this is a counter that is when somebody actually manually calls gc.collect, either their page or whether ASP.NET gets in a situation where they need to free up their cache, they will induce GC. That is something you want to avoid at pretty much all costs for a web server environment. It's okay for desktop applications to do collections and stuff, but something you definitely want to avoid on a web server environment.
Jeff, can I ask you get a couple questions from the audience here, if you don't mind, if you've got a couple of seconds in regards to this? The first question was asking, you had mentioned that ASP.NET caching drives CPU to 100%. Do you recall when you made that comment?
Yeah.
They were curious, are you talking about the output cache directive, or is there something else that you were referring to?
Well, for the output cache, it can, just like anything else, it can consume memory. I was more referring to just using the standard ASP.NET cache. For caching stuff like XML is usually a large culprit because you end up with this XML document that has literally hundreds of objects that are linked to it, most of them strings, and people like to cache XML for performance reasons. I mean, caching is not bad. I'm not saying that, but the guidance would be that you really get a handle on exactly what it is that you're caching, and you cache it in an intelligent way so that you're not overutilizing the cache. You cache only stuff that's hot, not stuff that's, maybe hit once or twice. The goal is to improve performance through caching. So you don't want to cache just about everything, because you will eventually drive the system into memory pressure, which has a very negative impact on performance.
Great. One other question that one of the attendees asked, which was asking a question regarding all of the tools that you're mentioning. They have a situation where they need to do mobile, debug Windows mobile apps. Is some of these tools work in that environment, or would they need to do other tools? Could you maybe comment, or if you don't know, we can maybe take it offline, but just out of curiosity, what is your take on that?
You know, to be honest, I haven't done any Windows Mobile debugging. I know there's probably at least one or two guys on the team that have done that. So I know there are tools, for sure. I wouldn't be surprised if they had specific tools just for the Compact framework that it might be a little bit different than like the kind of Spike debugger that we use, debugging extension. But I would imagine that they at least have some kind of debugging extension like Son of Strike if SOS doesn't work for mobile debugging.
Cool. There was one other question I just want to comment out loud, because they asked a question about your recycleapp.bbs that you use.
Yeah.
That I know I want to give a little bit of history just because, hey, I'm an IS and I want to make sure that everybody knows. On our team of Windows 2K3, IIS did not provide a mechanism out of the box for administrators or even for developers to do command line type of recycling. And what I mean by that is that we gave them the API to use, we just simply didn't give them a script to do it. Recycleapp.bbs is something used by Microsoft.com because they needed to be able to do that without opening the UI. In SP1, IIS app WAC or /R for the switch for R will recycle, and you just provided the PID and the app pull name. So if you were interested in the recycleapp.bbs tool, if you're at SP1, then you can grab that utility. It works fine because all the APIs that were used in that actual recycle function is in fact available on RTM. We just simply didn't get it in there. So I just wanted to make sure everybody knew that IIS.bbs has now the capability of doing command line recycling.
Yeah, but does it do it remote?
No, it doesn't, but we actually blogged about that. So that's a good one for you to, and I wrote an article on how to do that. You have to add that functionality, but you are correct. You got it. So Recycle app, WBS has that a little bit of an edge, as you could say, but.
I mean, really, it's just WMI calls to
log in and authenticate.
No? Issue the request. It's not a big deal.
Yes. But I just wanted to make sure that everyone knew, because yes, it is a Microsoft internal or a Microsoft.com operations utility, which we could certainly share if everybody wants that. But I just wanted to make sure they knew that natively it's available as well. So I'll turn it back over to you. I just wanted to make sure that we address those questions.
Well, how much more time do we got?
You got about another 26 minutes.
Okay.
Is what I'm being whispered in my ear. So that would mean that we are ready to go ahead and summarize. So can you summarize quickly for us, Jeff? You went over try-catch, you went over thread abort, and then looked at the GC. Can you kind of summarize in a few words each one of those major areas about what the Microsoft.com recommendations are?
Sure. I mean,
again?
Yeah. For exceptions, there's just a lot of overhead for handling an exception. Basically, you know, a stack walk is involved to find, you know, an exception handler that will actually handle the exception. And then, you know, if you have some finally calls, those get executed for you. Then your catch block gets called. And it's just a lot of extra overhead. You know, they have to generate context records to capture the context of the function. They actually, in a lot of cases, the exception object that gets created, they'll actually do a stack walk, and they'll actually pump that stack into the exception object, which is extremely cool because for debugging, you know, you just break down the exception, you dump out your exception object. Maybe I should show that real quick. Do we got time?
We got plenty of time, so you're welcome to do it.
All right. All right. So what I'm going to do here is I'll just set exception enable TLR go, and we'll go back to this guy. We'll go ahead and summon out that, put this back in place. Issue a request. Maybe. Okay. Oh, yeah. I guess I have to actually generate an exception on my thinking. Alright, so we've hit an exception. I can do a, I get the path to my debugger extension. For those of you that, are familiar with the debuggers, one nice feature about WinDDG is that it actually remembers your, debugger extensions that you have loaded. Section. There we go. Which is, it's a nice feature. So, I'll do a CLR stack. Show us this, stack for this particular exception. I'm gonna do a DSO, which is, dump stack objects. It's a shortcut for dump stack objects. Which reverses the stack and dumps out all managed objects on the stack. And, so, the interesting one here is this argument null exception. I can do a bang do on our object. And we can get our message, which is really not all that interesting because we already know what the exception is. I cannot be null. So, okay, fine. Let's go ahead and how many exceptions. So this particular request, if I look at it, fire it off, it's throwing three exceptions. Three exceptions for one request, which is really kind of bizarre. So I'm going to go ahead and enable CLR again. And let's look at this a little bit more in depth. So our first exception is thrown. You can see it's on the skip last right time, you can see. So, let's go again. Here's our second exception. And you can see if you look down near the bottom of the stack, it's the same as skip last right time, you can see. But the exception has now been gone through this process where the stack is unwound and they do search for exception handler. And it gets thrown up to that handler. So now we've actually added quite a few functions on top of the stack here. So we'll go ahead and dump stack object. So way up. So now we have a HTTP unhandled exception. We'll go ahead and dump that guy out. And, oh, not again. Okay. I don't know if you guys are still seeing this. My laptop's about to crash again. So we'll dump out this object. In this case, we have argument null exception. Message. Window, you know, value cannot be null, but we also have a stack trace, which is kind of interesting. So now it's captured the stack of the original exception. So if we do a DDS, which is, dump stack. Okay. Well, folks, I am sorry. It looks like my machine's acting up again. I must be burning it up.
So is this the perfect time for us to make sure that we tell folks, don't try this at home type of thing?
No.
Or
don't try this at home. This managed code debugging is, compared to native, in my opinion, managed code debugging is is awesome. It's just with the SLS extension and being able to dump out just about any object and follow objects or links from objects inside of objects, it's very convenient compared to doing a lot of the native debugging that we have to do. So usually, you know, internally here for native debugging, we have, you know, private debug symbols, and it gives us a lot of advantages for tracking down issues that a lot of you folks don't have. But with a managed code, it's just like that. I mean, it's great.
So this is really just a product of your machine overall. It's maybe not as stable as you would have liked it to be, and not a product of what you're doing.
It's a brand new Toshiba laptop.
Okay.
It appears to have some heat issues.
Yeah, I guess so. So everything you're doing here, I just want to calm the nerves of anybody
that's
not related to what you're doing.
Not at all. That's my host machine that's failing. It's not the machine that I was actually debugging. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to clarify that. I think that's really important. Do you maybe want? We got a lot of good questions here, Jeff. Do you want to, since that thing's getting a little hot and heavy? I do want to mention somebody was gracious enough that we put in the question. Someone had said if you check out the Windows Mobile MSDN.net 2.0 SDK, there's a mobile section. So for those of you that asked that question, you might want to go ahead and check out that just out of curiosity. So. A couple of other questions. It looks like on a system with many worker processes, Workstation GC is recommended. Are we talking about concurrent or non-concurrent GCs?
So it's non-concurrent, and you don't actually have to mess with that setting because ASP.NET takes care of it. All you have to set is the GC server enabled equals false in your ASP.NET config file, and ASP.NET handles the concurrency setting for you.
So they should be able to ignore that.
Yeah.
Okay. What another person was asking about was the overall, the do try finally block without the catch have the same overhead as the try catch?
Do try finally. So the flow of that is, it's essentially the same, right? The only difference is the finally is always guaranteed to be executed. So you're still going to generate an exception. The exception still, the handler that, or the function that is basically it's raise exception. So, the raise exception function call will still walk the stack. He'll look for exception handlers. So you still have that same overhead of building exception objects, traversing a stack, blah, 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 for a try finally. Except that what will happen is if your try does not catch the exception, it'll keep going up the stack looking for a handler that will actually handle the exception. And then once he finds a handler, your finally block will get executed first, and then it'll go back to the exception handler, the stack frame that handles the exception, and that will get executed after.
Cool. Hope that helps the person that asked that. Another question that I think is a really good question that I'm actually interested to see what the answer is. I actually see the answer now. But so assuming that you have one multi-core CPU, there will be two GC threads and two separate heaps. Is that correct?
Yeah. Multi-cores are considered two physical processors.
Yep. Okay, so there you see two CPUs and Task Manager, and then they'll see those two GC threads per process.
Correct.
Awesome. Yeah.
So when you have multiple worker processes, there is a situation where the server GC can work for you, but it is around having like an 8 or 16 way issue. So if your processors outnumber your worker processes, you have a kind of a better chance of succeeding there, but overall the recommendation is, look for a workstation, use the workstation GC.
Well, awesome. Jeff, thanks for this very interesting event, for sure, with the crashing of your laptop. That's a first in the IS Webcast series, I'll tell you that. We crashed the actual, main box we were working on, but we never crashed our host, so that's a first, and I'm glad Stucky was the one that it had happened to.
I'm kidding.
What I want to point out is, everybody, there's a lot of additional resources. These guys we are putting out on the forefront of making sure that you are aware that they are doing a lot of great work. They're not only participating in the IS Webcast series that we're obviously showing this week. We do have last November's presentations. If you go under deployment or under management under www.iswebcastseries.com, you'll see the Microsoft.com operations series. This was the preface to this talk that we're having here today, as well as all the talks this week. You can review all of those on demand and download the WMV as you wish at iswebcastseries.com. But also, I want to remind you that we have three more exciting webcasts this week to contribute to your knowledge about how Microsoft.com does business on a regular basis. We also have been regularly participating in the TechNet magazine, so make sure that you grab an edition of that, and you can find out some of these cool topics that you see listed here, especially the one at the bottom to support what Jeff talked about a lot yesterday, using Log Parser to find a denial of service baseline and analysis. That's a very interesting article that could build on what Jeff talked about yesterday. There's also a lot of great resources in the IT Showcase. We got them to write white papers about their environment. So if you want to know about how Microsoft.com does their business, this is where you go to find that out. As well as, you can also email them at mscomdlg@microsoft.com. And also, without forgetting that as well, make sure that you do visit their blog, the Microsoft.com. They're not going to be missing out on the latest, greatest technology, and that includes blogging. You can subscribe to their blog by just hitting this URL above, blogs.technet.com/mscom, and they will be able to share with you their daily wise ways of doing business. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and challenge all of you to make sure that you're asking your questions. You have them on the hook now for another 11 minutes, and you can use that to your advantage to find out any more information from Jeff or any of his colleagues. He brought several of his team with us today to talk, including yesterday's presenter, Jeffrey, and tomorrow's presenter, Jim, has joined us to answer your questions. So get those questions in now while you have that opportunity. We want to remind you that they will be coming back tomorrow. Jim will be talking to us about how to do some debugging on the ASP.NET world. And one key thing is, we will make sure he's not using a Toshiba laptop to ensure that it does stay up and running. That is a joke for those that don't know. That is my way, is to joke and have a good time while we're doing this. But let's make sure that you do know what resources are available to you. Ask your questions now, and do not forget to fill out your survey. We want to thank you for all coming today, and make sure that you come back and see us for the remainder of this week in a presentation, Microsoft.com Operations Real World Debugging. Thank you, everyone.
So we'll go ahead and monitor for questions here, and I'm just going to answer them out loud.
Yeah, we can do that. Let's let Tracy go ahead and get the slide out there and make sure that they know about how to submit their questions and answers.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Remember, for more information, everyone can print a PDF of today's session. So to do that, just go to the File menu in your navigation bar. And like you said, we will be getting to the questions and answers here shortly. So go ahead and feel free to submit your questions now. And I will be posting a survey here in just a moment. Please do take a minute to fill it out for us. We do appreciate your feedback. And for any upcoming and previously recorded webcasts, you can go to Microsoft.com/webcast. And you actually will find the first session of debugging yesterday and the session on there in about 24 hours. Or if you have any webcast content ideas, if there's anything out there that you haven't seen yet, we would love to hear from you. You can follow this link here. And just to let everybody know, today's webcast was presented using Microsoft Office Live Meeting. You can get a free 14-day trial by visiting this link. And for filling out that survey for us today, you are automatically entered in to win this 40GB MP3 Windows Media Player. So it gives you a little incentive to do that for us. Like I said, we appreciate your feedback on these webcasts. And here's the survey. Please follow the link provided to complete today's webcast evaluation. And I'll go ahead and hand it back over to Jeff so he can look at the questions we have in the queue.
Okay.
Hey, Jeff, do you want to go ahead and address the what about remote debugging?
I was just going to answer that.
Good deal.
So, remote debugging is not something that we typically do here in MS-COM. I'm guessing you're talking about, using like Visual Studio, the remote debugging functionality of their, which we don't do because we don't like to install that component on our machines, just for various reasons, security and so forth. We do, however, you know, the debugger does have, remote capabilities as far as creating a pipe that you can connect to from a remote machine. If you go into the, if you install the debugger package and actually look at the debugger help file and just search for .server, it'll show you how to create the remote pipe. So, you know, conceivably, it wouldn't be too much of a task to create a WMI script to launch a debugger against a remote process, you know, on the remote machine, and then use the .server pipe to connect to from another machine. So not extremely difficult, actually. And it's cool because if you're using like WinDBG in that scenario, if you have source access to code on your remote machine, it'll allow you to do source level debugging, which is very nice, very, very nice. Config entry for GC question equals true also. Also made in machine config or just yesterday. Okay, so the workstation GC setting GC server equals GC server enabled equals true or false is only in the ASP.NET config file. How many ASP.NET applications do you typically host in an app pool or a single worker process? We actually have a very interesting configuration with our main site, www.microsoft.com. We have upwards of over 200 applications, maybe 300 applications, and we segregate them into different app pools with a lot of different criteria. Some applications are extremely important to us, like the home page or download center, in which case we will generally give those applications their own dedicated app pool. Other applications are that we know are problematic, we will isolate those from everybody that we know is good. So we have what we call untrusted app pools, where we just throw in either unknown or known poorly performing applications into that app pool so they can only hurt themselves. But generally, we have five or six app pools that have pretty isolated applications in them, and then the rest are shared, another five or six that are shared application pools.
So can I ask you a quick question?
Uh-huh.
All right. My question is related to what if I am new to debugging? I know this is a 300 level, but wonder, how did you get your start? How did you get into understanding how to debug native and manage code?
Yeah, cool. Just come work at Microsoft, join product support.
Okay, without doing that, what would you recommend to our customers to enhance that skill?
There are actually quite a few books out there right now on debugging managed applications. Not as many around native applications, I would say. Just because they're really kind of different. And like I said, managed code, in my opinion, is a lot easier to debug. So I you know, honestly, I just kind of do some Googling on debugging resources. There are some classes too that I don't know. I don't think they're official Microsoft curriculum, but there's some definite classes out there for debugging. I know actually one of the guys on our team, he does some debug training external to Microsoft. But you know, really, it's just you know, installing the debug package and attach to your work process and just start looking at exceptions and Visual Studio is great because, you know, they have built in debugging in that. So the best way to start debugging is to actually start writing your own code and just thinking around with it and seeing what breaks and seeing what works. And
so practice, basically, is the best approach for anyone that's wanting to get into figuring out, especially for IT professionals. They just simply need to attach to processes and start playing with the commands and figuring out exactly how to go about finding the data that they're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on what you're trying to, you know, to debug. It really does. If you're trying to debug a performance issue, you know, maybe you look at kern rate and you look at the functions that are being called, and then you say, okay, I know I have, you know, function 1 and function 2 that are getting hit pretty heavy. I'm going to attach to the debugger. I'm going to set a breakpoint on this function, break in, and then I'm going to look at the call stack, and I'm going to try to figure out, okay, what functions are leading up to this call, and then try to determine from there. But it's, you know, that can be hard if you don't know, you know, the internals of the OS as far as, you know, what's going on there. So there's definitely some good resources as far as, like, how the CLR works. I sent this out, but Jeff Richter has a new book called CLR via C#, that is great as far as covering the CLR and its internals. I mean, I pulled some of the resources for you guys out of this book. It's really a phenomenal book. He's also got an earlier book, which is Applied Microsoft.NET Framework Programming. Basically, it's the same thing, an earlier version. So the new book I would recommend, CLR via C#. And then for the OS, there's the Bible.
Yeah, Inside Windows.
Yeah.
Everybody should know about Inside Windows. If you don't know about that, then just do a Google on Inside Windows, and you'll find what you're looking for.
That is for sure the Bible.
That is.
And then if you really, you know, want to get geeky on at least the CLR, there's a Winterlight puts out a book called Customizing the .NET Framework, Common Language Runtime. So it's Customizing, and then search for CLR, and you'll probably find that from Winterlight. And that actually goes into if you want to host the CLR yourself as opposed to, you know, ASP.NET hosting it.
Yes.
You can do all kinds of cool stuff.
So besides that, I think you nailed the question. There's a lot of resources out there for folks to get into this detail. Obviously, I don't want to discourage folks. I mean, that's why we're having this very series here this week. In all of this information that you're getting from Jeff and you're getting from Jeffrey yesterday, as well as what we give the remainder of the week, it's going to be made available to everyone so that they can use this either as a beginning or also try to advance their ability to find out what's going on their servers and really reduce headaches that are occurring. So with that said, I have 11 o'clock. There's still a lot of questions in here. Jeff, would you and your gang be willing to stay around and answer the questions in writing?
Yeah.
Then awesome. What we can do then is we'll have them stay around for a little bit and answer some questions, but as this stands on the audio portion, and we'll go ahead and turn it back to Tracy to complete this presentation.
Great. Thanks, Chris. I do want to extend a special thanks to Jeff for presenting today, and also a big thank you to Chris for logging on and helping us out with this session. And thanks to the audience for attending today's TechNet webcast. This does conclude the audio portion of today's session. The audience may now disconnect.